I want to thank the people of the city of Syracuse for giving me the privilege of a lifetime. It is a privilege that I have endeavored to honor every single day. And I think that sense of honor was started right here in this very room. In the fall of 1988, I sat right there where now Joe Gorsuch, who's on my staff, sits. And coming back here 29 years later is a real sense of symmetry. Although back then I would have called it a sense of synchronicity. Those of you who are alive in the 80s will know exactly what that reference is about. I had no idea when I sat in that seat that one day I would be mayor of the city of Syracuse. But in November of 2009, my life changed in ways that I could never have imagined and in ways that I am supremely grateful for. But what changed immediately was that I lost my first name. My name, Stephanie, disappeared, and I became mayor. Now, the first couple of times that happened to me, I would look behind me to see if any of my predecessors were around, and I would realize the people in Syracuse were talking to me. Now, to be fair, when I left Syracuse, I was often not the only person who had a hard time with the vision of me as mayor. In January of 2010, while attending Governor Patterson's State of the State address, at that time, Governor Patterson provided me and the other mayors with a state police escort. Now, today when I go to the Capitol, I have to have a state police escort for different reasons. But that's the subject of another discussion. The state police escort, who happened to be a woman, guided me into the Capitol along with some people who were with me. And she said to the security guards, "Could you please clear the way? I have the mayor of Syracuse with me." And the security guards dutifully cleared the way. And then they looked at Patrick Mannion. Patrick, would you please stand up for us? They looked at Patrick Mannion, who is clearly the physical visitation of what a mayor of the city of Syracuse should look like. And they said, "Go ahead, sir." And everyone was aghast. And I looked at the state trooper, and she said to me, "Don't worry, they'll get used to you soon enough." Now, I'm not sure if they have gotten used to me or not, but nevertheless, there were times, and they continue to be when I leave Syracuse, that people have a hard time saying, "You're the mayor?" Where they don't have a hard time and have never had a hard time is here in the city of Syracuse. A few months after that State of the State address, I was at a kindergarten in Blodgett Elementary School. And I was talking about being mayor and what the mayor did. And this very studious young boy raised his hand. And I could tell he had a burning question, like only a five-year-old you can read on a five-year-old's face. And I pointed to him and I said, "Yes." And he said, "Can boys be mayors too?" And I said, "Yes. Boys can be mayors." No, in Syracuse, I immediately became the mayor. And the respect of using the title went along with the expectation that I would try to solve people's problems. And it didn't matter what the problem was, overabundance of deer, shortage of primary care physicians, income inequality. If it impacted their lives, and everything impacts my constituents' lives, they expected me to deal with it. So there's a fundamental question you have to answer when that comes at you. At least I had to answer. And that was, how are you going to deal with it when everybody expects you to address their problems? Now, with the little problems, negotiations and management and different sort of conflicts, institutional conflicts, my line was always to the person in front of me, "I got 99 problems. It's up to you if you want to be 99 or 100. And while I said that to him, in my mind, I would hum to myself, "If you're having girl problems, I feel bad for you, son. I got 99 problems. I'm not going to finish the line." It made me chuckle. For those of you who don't know what the next line is, turn to somebody who's under 30 and they will tell you. But the big problems where leadership matters, poverty, violence, justice, and 95 of the 99 problems that I had were rooted in those. How do you navigate those problems? One of the first problems that I confronted immediately was gun violence. That first summer of my administration was a bloody summer. And what seemed like every Sunday night, I would receive a notification from Chief Fowler about a murder that was more senseless than you can even imagine. And inevitably, it was two young black men. And these private notifications were followed by weeks of public cries, take people's guns away, give people more guns, do a gun buyback program. All of them, often well-meaning people, self-declared experts, giving these neat, simple solutions to really complex problems. And they would die down until the next murder, and it would start all over again. So I did what I was taught to do in this very room. I read, and I researched, and I read. And I found that none of those hot take solutions worked. And yet what felt like it was every Sunday night, I would receive a notification call from Chief Fowler. And I was racked with feelings of desperation and with failure. Right after Thanksgiving of that year, on November 28th, 2010, at around 5 o'clock, my phone rang. And it was Chief Fowler to give me a notification that a 20-month-old child, Rashad Walker Jr., had been shot to death in his car seat. He was an innocent victim of gang violence. The shooter had been looking for the toddler's father. It was the lowest point of my administration. I went to the funeral, and I stood in line in this hot, packed church with the grief so intense you could feel it. And I leaned down to offer my condolences to the toddler's father, who was 19 years old. And I looked at him, and I realized that he was the only person in that church, in our city, and in fact the whole community who had no idea what he had lost. Weeks later, as if it was some cosmic affirmation of my feelings about it, a reporter asked him, "What would you have said to the man who killed your son?" And he said, "You missed." But at that moment, when I looked at him, I realized I had a choice. I could relegate this violent experience as an aberration and say that it was other people, that it was not my city, that it was not my neighborhood, that it was not my community. Distinguish myself. And let's be honest, that's the easiest choice in the world to make. Because it's not easy to admit that in your community, a 20-month-old can die a violent death. But it happens. It happens in our city and in communities across this country. And there are lots of people who don't have the luxury of escaping that reality. So at that moment, I decided to accept it and not to distinguish it, to say this was mine. These were my people and my family and my community and my city. And when I did that, I understood that in order to solve a problem, you have to understand it. And in order to understand it, you have to find your shared humanity. And you only do that through reflection and introspection, not by distinguishing yourselves. So here's what I learned. There is a thin line between victim and assailant in youth gun violence. And in fact, Rashad Walker Sr., who is in prison right now for murder, a couple of days before that murder, he shot a young man holding a baby. That to stop such senseless violence, you need the entire community to get involved. Coaches, teachers, neighbors, leaders. That to ask the police alone to solve it is an exercise in futility. And that the places where people have been successful in mitigating gun violence, they have done it by building relationships over time, not by one-offs. And so we went to the community and we formed Q's Cares, an umbrella organization that oversees several programs from Syracuse Truce to Save Our Youth to Cure Violence. Sharon Owens is here, who's been in the middle of all of them. We used evidence and deterrence to interrupt the violence and to ask and involve whole sections of our community. With our goal being, as others have written, to tackle the hardest cases with a combination of empathy and resolve, offering assistance if it will be accepted, but accountability for brutal behavior. Now, gun violence is still horrific. You don't solve community problems, deep-seated community problems, overnight. They're not one-offs. You need to look at it as an investment. But unfortunately, in the times that we live in, the types of programs that are funded are often funded on a budget cycle and are often stopped because it's politically advantageous to spin a situation to a partisan advantage. And to give a hot take, to have a press conference declaring victory through an ideological view and ignoring all evidence to the contrary. Now, gun violence is not Syracuse's problem alone. We know that. No, we in Syracuse are not separate and apart from our nation's troubles. During my tenure, Michael Brown and Eric Gardner and Freddie Gray's deaths illuminated long simmering problems in our country. And Syracuse was one of the few places that had escaped these conflagrations that were ripping through other cities. And I had believed it was because we had meaningfully worked on community bonds, in part by being honest about youth violence. In the wee hours of the morning of June 20th, 2016, I got a call from Chief Fowler. And when I answered, he said to me, "We've got a real problem." And I knew from that moment, by his tone and the variation in our normal protocol, that we did have a real problem. He went on to explain to me the facts as he knew them at that moment. A dead man, an injured police officer, multiple shots fired, a missing gun, and a neighborhood riot. The next morning, I went straight to the scene, and it was filled with people, investigators collecting evidence, the housing authority collecting refuse from the chaos that had been the night before, people replacing bullet-riddled windows. I got out of the car, and I went over to an older woman who was sitting on her stoop. She looked up at me, and she said, "Mayor, we got no problems here. Children were having a good time, people were dancing, and the cops rolled up and they started shooting into the crowd." And when she said that to me, I knew two things. The first was that that didn't happen. And the second was that she wasn't lying to me. When I listened to her, I knew that we could not escape the painful history of our country, and we were going to have these discussions as well. It was racing through our country, and it was going to race through us. It's our history as Americans, and thus we all have to be accountable for it. For me, it had been a painful year of news stories. But for her, it had likely been a lifetime of witness injustices. And that lifetime of experiences was the prism through which she was going to see this event and the aftermath. Now, the day after such a chaotic event is when the narrative is established. And when there are no clear facts, actually, especially when there are no clear facts, you have a riot and a dead man and a police officer involved, you have a toxic and combustible mix. Everyone's instinct is to jump to conclusions, and social media is on fire with unsubstantiated claims. And indeed, in Syracuse, social media was bubbling with people who had said there had been no gunfire, that the dead man had not been armed, that the police had been unnecessarily and aggressively engaged with a peaceful Father's Day party. And well-intentioned people in the climate we are living in thought it might be true. But while they thought it might be true, they were willing to ask me if it was. And most, after I asked them to withhold judgment until all the facts were gathered, did. They listened, but they also asked me to listen to them. And here's what I told and showed them. On Father's Day 2016, just after 11 p.m., a call came for a man down on Atisco Street. When the officer arrived, she could find no man, but found a crowd of between 300 and 400 people. While waiting for backup to help her disperse the crowd, she heard numerous gunshots, causing her to run towards the shots fired. As she was running, she observed three men firing handguns and ordered them to drop their weapons. When they refused, she fired her weapon. When she stopped to clear her jammed weapon, she saw another man within feet of her firing a handgun, and according to multiple witnesses, repeatedly ordered him to drop his weapon. He refused, and she pursued him as he turned his body in her direction, and she shot him in the upper back, which ultimately killed him. Several witnesses identified a man who lived nearby and was known to have felony and weapons convictions pick up the dead man's gun. After the police officer shot her weapon, she was immediately attacked by a mob. She was beaten, groped, and the crowd attempted to rip her uniform off and take her firearm until other officers rescued her. The investigation recovered a total of 37 shell casings, and at least 4 to 5 semi-automatic firearms were discharged at least 30 times. Witness statements identified the man who picked up the gun and his criminal history as the catalyst for a high-risk search warrant procedure involving riot gear and the Bearcat, and to this day, the gun is still missing. And while I showed that and asked and told people about that, here's what they said to me. They were frustrated and fearful about how our culture values the lives of Black people. When a mother tells you that she is worried about her 4-year-old son's life because of the state of our country, you cannot ignore it. And indeed, when two mothers, young women, at a meeting at St. Lucie's Rectory, told me of their worries, it was like hearing a primal scream. A scream for justice and a scream for people to recognize injustice. And it didn't matter that the primal injustice was not the Father's Day event. It was the emotional opening for them, and I think they hoped for us. Now, in light of or because of the Father's Day event, there were a number of people who self-identified as Black Lives Matter. And it was a very tenuous time because there had been a march in Dallas where a police officer had been shot. The Black Lives Matter folks said to me that they wanted to march, and we worked with the local organizers to ensure that they could exercise their guaranteed First Amendment rights and to have the opportunity to peacefully present their grievances. On our part, that meant being very conscious of our police presence. We did not want this.
Platoon!
Forward!
Shield!
Kneel!
Down! Platoon!
Forward!
Port arms!
Hey! 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 H
It meant that we wanted to show people that we believed that they could exercise their grievances according to their constitutional rights. And it meant going on City Hall steps and talking to marchers when they asked and staying inside when they didn't. Within hours of the start of the first march, and there were three, a story appeared about downtown businesses closing because of fears of the march. I immediately started making phone calls to try to trace who was doing this. I eventually traced it back to the management of the federal building. And when pressed, the sanitized explanation was that they didn't want people's cars to get stuck in traffic due to the march. By the way, they have never done that for any of the huge festivals downtown. This was a first, and it was garbage. They had made a snap judgment without talking to anyone that the march was dangerous. The irony, of course, is that the very building that houses the government, created by the Constitution, closes when Americans say they're going to exercise that right guaranteed in that document. But more to the point, what does it communicate to those mothers who are worried that the country does not value the lives of their sons? There's an interesting paradox in cities. It's a modern construct where you take a whole bunch of strangers, often ostracized, gays, immigrants, poor people, and you push them all together and you say, figure it out. And that process of figuring it out is an essential element of democracy. Because you see, proximity brings conflict. Sometimes the conflict is small, like barking dogs. Sometimes the conflict is large, like the meaning of equal justice under the law. But in our modern society, when Facebook, Twitter, and anonymous comments are vehicles to vent without an opportunity to think, without an opportunity for reflection, it separates us. You make a judgment on face value, and you put it on social media, and you're done. But what does it do to our ability to solve problems if we don't listen to each other? What does it do if we won't even take the time to reflect and to find the facts out before we take a position? If we are so busy to get to that judgment, the hot take, without examining all the facts, then how will we ever find justice or equity if we won't even stop to listen to each other? Now, equity is an easy word to say, yet it is very hard to actualize. 79% of the students in the Syracuse City School District are economically disadvantaged. But what does that mean? Those of us who don't live it, I think, often romanticize it. Sayings like, well, you know, my family was poor, but we didn't know it. Or we didn't have much, but we got by and we worked hard. Let me tell you what it means in Syracuse. In Syracuse, it means you rent a two-bedroom apartment for you and your two children, and your apartment is not the greatest. The paint is chipping on the walls, and your kitchen faucet isn't working. But it's a roof over your head and not a shelter. You don't have the money to take care of chipping paint in your apartment, so your children are at risk of lead poisoning. You didn't graduate from high school and are currently struggling to obtain your GED and finish a job training program. Looking for work is hard. Not having a high school degree immediately eliminates you from jobs, and even with a GED, you will struggle in our new economy. You rely on social services to help support your family, and you hear the message over and over again that if you work, you will lose some or possibly all of your benefits. Your youngest, still too small to attend school, stays with your mom because a certified child care program is too expensive. Your part-time job has constantly changing shifts, so when you're gone in the morning, your oldest has to take his brother to your mom's house before heading to school. This often makes him late, which has started to get him into trouble with his teacher and is impacting his grades. He is struggling with schoolwork, and he is frustrated and gets into a lot of fights, often ending in detention or, worse, suspended. This means he is home alone and more likely to get into trouble when you are working. You are worried about paying the rent this month. You've been evicted twice this year. And you don't want to move the kids again. You might have to let the heat bill slide this month and add some extra blankets to the kids' beds. If you do find full-time work at a minimum wage job, you're walking a thin line. Based on the current minimum wage in New York State, you would take home $816 a month. Your rent is $667 a month, not including utilities. This means you are housing cost burden, with more than 30% of your income going towards housing costs. You receive an average of $379 a month from SNAP, which helps pay for groceries. When your food money runs low by the end of the month, you buy unhealthy processed food because it will last longer. And if all the money is gone, you have to go to the Samaritan Center for free meals. You can use food pantries too, but that can be complicated as well, because each one is open on different days and different hours, and you can only go once a month to each pantry. You have no car, and you have to rely on buses to get around the city. The bus also takes extra time, but you have to take the bus. When you have to take the bus, your work options become even more limited. Buses typically do not run to employment hubs located outside the city at night and during off-peak shift hours. When you are constantly having to move or risk homelessness or go a winter month without heat, you and your family risk physical and psychological trauma. Living in poverty impacts every part of your ability to get out of it. And it's not just here in Syracuse or in upstate New York. If trends continue, one out of every seven students in New York City will be homeless by the time they reach fifth grade. Yet we as a society take these children who live these issues every day, and we deposit them at the school and we say, compete with your wealthier suburban counterparts, and we wonder why the results are dramatically different. And yet on that first day of school that I have gone to every year as mayor, and I suspect happened long before I was mayor and long after I was mayor, every single one of the children that I have seen walks into school with different faces and different backgrounds and these challenges, but they all have sparkling new shoes. For parents living this reality, buying new shoes for their children is a statement, and it's a sacrifice of hope about the future. Those shoes have always, to me, been a consecrated sign of the hopes and beliefs that parents have in our school system. A trust that the school will develop and nurture talent. They believe, and I think we all believe, that talent is universal. But opportunity is not. And so why is it, when New York State spends the most per pupil in the United States, that opportunity is not universal? Well, the hot take is clearly that schools are wasting money and that the teachers are incompetent. And the hot take on the other side is that, oh, we're just fighting and fighting to get more money and get more money. But if you look deeper at the data, you will discover that New York State has the most racially segregated schools in the United States. And racial and poverty segregation create educational challenges related directly to unequal opportunity. Studies show that when students are socialized in schools in which few students have benefited from the advantages and power that middle-class families possess and exercise on behalf of their children, they are poorly prepared for institutions of higher learning and good jobs, which are largely white middle-class institutions. The informal contacts that children get in suburban schools develop into better opportunity and better information, and that also remains segregated. So thus, this segregation perpetuates racial and economic inequality. Now, New York State has long had a practice of maintaining its school aid for every district, no matter how much each district spends. And the state doesn't want to reduce foundation aid for any district, regardless of its actual need or changing demographics or decreasing enrollment. The greatest need, of course, is in poor districts, but wealthy districts are stronger politically. And as a result, wealthy districts, often largely white, keep getting more and more, and poor districts, largely children of color, can never catch up. So simply adding money to the foundation aid doesn't address the fundamental flaws in the current distribution formula. And so given this data, the Syracuse versus Jamesville DeWitt Skinny Atlas graduation chart makes a lot more sense. Now we know, of course, that our children face huge challenges and barriers due to grinding poverty. And while I will continue to argue for the state to meet its long-delayed court-ordered responsibilities to adequately fund our school district, the other thing that we did that was much more effective was we used our partnership with Say Yes to Education and Onondaga County to make sure that we could develop a model whereby we entice families to stay engaged in the educational system by promising free college tuition. But most important, we used our resources to put various types of support in schools for students and their families to enhance opportunities for academic achievement, from legal and health services to mental health support to after-school programs. To try and mitigate some of the factors that I read to you earlier. And I believe that this has helped increase our graduation rate, far from our goal, but the highest it's been in 10 years. And because of Say Yes to Education, more than 2,900 Syracuse students have gone to college, most of whom would not have been able to go to college without the Say Yes promise. Now, New York State is often not a productive partner in this effort to meet these challenges. Grant Middle School, one of our middle schools, was deemed persistently struggling by the state and given 1 year to improve or to have a receiver appointed. Now, appointing a receiver is an act that has very rarely, if ever, led to better academic achievement. But the administration and the teachers got to work and they devised a plan. Start the day earlier, have the day go longer, personalize the curriculum for every student, use real-time data, restorative discipline, not suspension. Now, of course, there were costs associated with all of these actions, but the state had given extra money to help address persistently struggling schools. And lo and behold, Grant showed drastic improvements on the state exams and was no longer threatened with receivership. And New York State responded by taking away the funding for the programs that had helped get them off of receivership. Now, the parents were ultimately forced to sue, and ultimately they won, and the funding was restored. Now, the ultimate goal, of course, of our education system is to create productive members of our community. And that's a code word for employees. But people need jobs in order to be employees. And jobs, economic development, is the holy grail of Syracuse. And I think that's because it's in our institutional and psychological memories. Because Syracuse was once one of the 30 largest, wealthiest cities in the United States. Higher incomes, better education, higher standards. Jobs with employers like General Electric, Syracuse China, and, of course, Carrier. In 1921, Syracuse was described this way. We manufacture more typewriters than any other city in the world, more soda products than any other city in the world, more auto parts and gears than any city in the world. Last vacation, I was on an old farm in Maine, and standing in the corner was a Syracuse plow. Hanging next to it was a Dietz lantern made in Syracuse. And clearly, that is far from where we are now. And in fact, all 12 of New York State's metropolitan statistical areas had economic growth rates below the national average in 2016. And data indicates that if upstate were its own state, our job growth would rank fourth worst in the nation, below, among others, Mississippi. And 88% of the net jobs that came to upstate New York during the last 8 years have been in low-wage sectors, led by restaurants and bars. Now, to change this trend, the focus has been on altering governmental policies, reducing tax burdens, spending money on large economic development projects, specifically focusing on providing efforts to promote regional growth. And, of course, these come along with the big exciting announcements and the ribbon cuttings and the job creation announcements. But it's not working. So why is it not working? Well, upstate New York metropolitan areas are distinctive for the amount of economic segregation that exists between cities and suburban areas. Upstate cities have higher percentages of poor people than the Rust Belt average, and regional strategies that do not focus on the needs of upstate cities who have been hit hardest by the growth of poverty over the last decade. You see, because cities are home to people who compete least effectively for jobs. Poor educational attainment, criminal records, transportation difficulties. For these reasons, traditional economic development or tax incentive strategies are unlikely to benefit them. And instead, strategies that directly address obstacles that prevent city residents from getting good full-time jobs would be more likely to mitigate poverty. So if the economic strategy is not creating jobs, and it's leaving behind huge swaths of people, then why are we still doing it? Well, the answer is because even failed policies benefit some people. And who do these policies benefit? Politicians and campaign contributors. These big, exciting announcements I mentioned earlier, the ceremonial shoveling, the ribbon cuttings, followed by the ubiquitous huge job creation numbers, they become the omnipresent campaign mailers and TV commercials. Propaganda by any other name. Propaganda aimed at you to communicate, "I care about jobs." Together, the campaign contributors and the politicians form this virtually impregnable alliance where they direct public resources towards the contributors' projects, regardless of the project's merit. Now, most of us who are not undergraduate students here remember Destiny. Nothing like it in the world. Which was actually true if you considered the preposterous claims about the project. On October 24th of 2002, the Pyramid Group held a groundbreaking for the Grand Destiny Hotel. The ceremony was billed as the start on a construction of a 47-story, 1,300-room, $180 million hotel. And the event attracted 3,000 people, including politicians who could and did play a role in getting government incentives. It all seemed so surreal because it was. A couple of years later, in litigation papers, the former Destiny CEO admitted there was never an intention to build anything. When asked why the ceremony was held, the CEO referenced the governor's campaign and re-election and said, quote, "The intent was to show that what we wanted to do as opposed to actually doing something." The Grand Destiny was never built. Nothing like it in the world became a typical mall. The good jobs and record-breaking sales tax revenue never materialized. But Destiny received governmental subsidies totaling $600 million. And politicians received thousands of dollars in campaign contributions. And the cycle of contributions followed by giveaways continues to this day, as does the list of failed economic development projects. But the Destiny Project did something else. It took this short girl in an oversized black suit, and it made her an advocate. It made me understand that we Syracusans are a hardy people, often born into adversity, but refusing to use that as an excuse to accept second best. Like that five-year-old who asked me if boys can be mayor, he did something that we Syracusans all do. We dream of a future that looks different, but includes us. The people of Syracuse, not the campaign contributors or the recipients, but the people who buy new shoes for their children on the first day of school. The people who see our boys, not thugs, when they want to end gun violence. The people who understand that justice is seen through a prism of many different lights. The people who experience tragedy and triumph with grace and dignity, those people. Those people ask for and wanted and voted for a fighter because that's who they are. People who struggle to fight adversity and through those struggles hold on to their aspirations for themselves and for each other. Now, our struggles as a community to solve challenges, to constructively answer how we together can move forward, demands the reflection to get effective solutions. If we relegate ourselves to our culture's rush to judgment, to take things at face value, to decide a position after reading 140 characters, to condone the metaphorical and often literal screaming at each other, then we almost ensure we will not be able to make progress. I have thought a great deal about this as I move closer to reclaiming my first name and relinquishing my title. And while our issues seemed to be caused by the rapid change inherent to our modernity, I have been reminded that they are not. And in fact, they are as old as our country itself. In arguing for the adoption of our Constitution, Alexander Hamilton, a good New Yorker, and somebody who's being recognized more and more, wrote in Federalist Number 1, "It has been frequently remarked that it seems to have been reserved to the people of this country by their conduct and example to decide the important question, whether societies of men are really capable or not of establishing good government from reflection and choice, or whether they are forever destined to depend for their political constitutions on accident and force." If there be any truth in the remark, the crisis at which we are arrived may with propriety be regarded as the era in which that decision is to be made. He wrote this in 1787. Now, some 230 years later, we face our own crisis of reflection. And it is up to us, as Syracusans, as New Yorkers, and as Americans, to once again take Hamilton's words to heart and to demonstrate that we are capable of establishing good government from reflection and choice. It is my plan to do that on January 1st, 2018, as Stephanie Miner, just as I have endeavored to do that since January 1st, 2010, as Mayor Miner. Thank you, Syracuse.